Today is Friday, April 16th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Tinedua for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, experts warn of U.S. Afghan troops pullout.
It is my hope that the U.S. will continue to support the government of Afghanistan principally through financial means.
Also, President Biden meets with Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga.
The two leaders are expected to present a united front on Taiwan, China's most sensitive territorial issue.
Plus, another U.S. shooting kills eight in Indianapolis. These stories and more are next. Experts are warning that the announced U.S. departure from Afghanistan will lead to intensified conflict, while Afghan women say they are worried about their rights. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports on U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's efforts to reassure Afghan leaders during an unannounced visit Thursday.
Secretary of State Anthony Blinken arrived in Kabul with one central message for the Afghan people. The United States is not abandoning the country.
We have a partnership that is changing but enduring.
His visit came one day after President Joe Biden announced all U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan before the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Afghan National Reconciliation Head Abdullah Abdullah asked for continued U.S. support.
Decision about the moving to the next phase, into the next chapter, we respect that. But at the same time, thank you for your continued commitment and support of peace.
Afghan women leaders worry their two decades of hard-won gains in women's rights will be lost and are calling for regional and international guarantees.
Of course, women's rights, those rights that Afghan women want in their framework of Islam, would be 100% threatened.
Secretary Blinken addressed the issue while in Kabul.
We'll continue to support civil society and to advocate for equal rights for women, including their meaningful participation in the ongoing negotiations and their equal representation throughout society.
There are also concerns about even greater violence in the war-torn country, say experts such as former U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Richard Olson.
And I think it is likely that Afghanistan will be going into a period of intensified conflict. It is my hope, and I believe this will be the U.S. policy as well, that the U.S. will continue to support the government of Afghanistan principally through financial means.
Secretary Blinken said Thursday the only path forward to a lasting end to Afghanistan's conflict is through negotiations, a political agreement, and compromise. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Afghan government officials and citizens alike share the same mixed feelings, fear, apprehension, and hope following President Joe Biden's announcement that American troops will be withdrawn by September 11th. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's trip to sell the plan has done little to reassure a nervous population, especially women, who fear the return of the Taliban's harsh policies. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
There are serious concerns, especially among women in Afghanistan, that this departure will allow the Taliban to try to take control of Kabul militarily. Taliban are known for their hardline policies, harsh Islamic policies, and that's what is the major concern for ordinary population in Afghanistan, and that's why the government was worried, civil society was worried that what's going to happen, it's going to lead to a lot of uncertainty.
Any reaction from the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban came out with a comprehensive statement on Thursday, and it is interesting to note that it was being widely anticipated that if the United States goes ahead and abandons the May 1st deadline for the foreign troops to leave Afghanistan that had been agreed to with the Taliban in this February 2020 agreement, there will be a serious reaction from the Taliban. But what we understand from the statement that they issued in several languages on Thursday, that they are basically criticizing the United States for not living up to its commitment and for breaching the agreement that the two sides had signed in Doha a year ago. So it was sort of a weird threat that, you know, Taliban may take some countermeasures now that the U.S. has delayed its military withdrawal for several months. But what we understand from our sources that it seems that regional countries, particularly Pakistan and others, have played a role in convincing the Taliban that logistically it was not maybe possible for the United States and thousands of NATO forces to leave Afghanistan at such a short notice, and there were reasons for the delay. And it seems maybe the insurgents have been convinced to just live with this several months of delay and not react so violently and let the foreign forces leave the country. I mean, this is how the statement is being interpreted, that the reaction was there, but it is not that harsh. And we haven't seen over the last 2-3 days any major Taliban attacks in the battlefield or elsewhere. So the hope is that maybe Taliban would want to wait foreign forces out of the country, and then they may intensify their effort to grab power. But we will still have to see how things unfold, because a lot of regional countries are playing their role to make sure that the departure of foreign forces from Afghanistan does not mean more violence in Afghanistan, because it's certainly going to destabilize the entire region and countries which are bordering Afghanistan.
That's my colleague Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. U.S. allies, including Britain, have announced they too will begin pulling their troops out of Afghanistan following Washington's announcement it intends to withdraw all American armed forces personnel by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. Harry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain has 750 troops in Afghanistan, part of the NATO mission to train Afghan forces. Within months, those Afghan forces will be on their own. The U.S. announcement that it will withdraw all its troops by September 11th means NATO allies will also pull out.
We plan to complete the withdrawdown for all our troops within a few months.
The withdrawal by British and NATO troops was inevitable, says analyst Julie Norman.
The U.S. presence there really enabled a lot of the logistical support that enabled NATO troops to be there.
Britain was among the first U.S. allies to join the invasion of Afghanistan, which was triggered by the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Nearly two decades on, the former head of the British Armed Forces fears for the future of the country.
I think many people will argue that the Taliban will effectively have a summer holiday and then assume they can come back in the autumn when the Americans have left and much of NATO has drawn down, and then continue their armed disputes with the Afghan government and expect to prevail.
Over 450 British troops were killed in the Afghan conflict. In total, more than 3,500 NATO service personnel, including US soldiers, have lost their lives. For the US and its allies, the Afghan withdrawal is a watershed moment to reflect on what has been achieved in two decades of conflict. For Afghanistan, the fight for democracy and freedom is far from over. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga will present a united front on Taiwan, China's most sensitive territorial issue, in a summit meeting on Friday, according to a senior U.S. administration official. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is set to meet U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday. The two leaders are expected to present a united front on Taiwan, China's most sensitive territorial issue. That's according to a senior U.S. official who said Suga and Biden plan to put out a joint statement on preserving the status quo in the self-governed Taiwan, a democratic island which Beijing claims as its own. It's Biden's first in-person meeting with a foreign leader as he seeks to reallocate U.S. military and diplomatic resources to the Indo-Pacific in an effort to counter China's growing power. Biden and Suga are also set to discuss Beijing's treatment of Muslims in Xinjiang and its tightening grip on Hong Kong, while announcing a $2 billion Japanese investment in 5G telecommunications to counter China's Huawei. The summit comes a day after several of Biden's emissaries met with Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen, pledging to work together to deter the threat of heightened Chinese military activity. But the joint statement on Taiwan is likely to fall short of U.S. expectations, as Japan struggles to balance its deep economic ties with China and navigate frosty relations with fellow U.S. ally South Korea. Relations between Tokyo and Seoul have frayed over issues connected to Japan's former colonization of Korea. The senior Biden official says he is expected to discuss how this friction has impeded U.S. objectives in the region. The official added that Biden and Suga are expected to bolster efforts with the other Quad countries, Australia and India, as well as South Korea, in order to counter China's influence in the region, and will announce plans for their next meeting on Friday.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. Beijing says it has expressed serious concerns to the United States and Japan over what it calls negative moves and collusion between the two countries against China. The statement from the foreign ministry spokesperson comes just before President Joe Biden welcomes Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga to the White House on Friday in his first face-to-face meeting with a foreign leader. That meeting is seen as reflecting Biden's emphasis on strengthening alliances to deal with a more assertive China and other global challenges. Amid ongoing mass shootings in the United States, Americans remain divided on how to reduce the carnage from these events and also from isolated shootings. Gun violence claims the lives of tens of thousands of victims each year. Mike O'Sullivan has more from experts on possible solutions.
A shooting in Knoxville, Tennessee on April 12th left one student dead and a police officer wounded. In Georgia, eight people were killed last month at three spas, six of the victims Asian women. 10 were shot and killed at a Colorado supermarket less than a week later. In California, 4 dead, including a 9-year-old boy, on March 31st. National leaders have been at a loss for words.
I even hate to say it because we're saying it so often. My heart goes out. Our hearts go out for the survivors.
The full picture is even worse. Last year, nearly 20,000 Americans died from gun violence. Another 24,000 committed suicide with guns, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Americans remain divided over gun ownership.
We have a lot of people who think there are too many guns in America and that the key to reducing gun violence, which by all accounts is far too common in the United States, is to restrict access to guns restrict access to particular kinds of weapons. Another half of the country is firmly convinced that the way to reduce gun violence is more guns.
At least 40% of Americans live in a home with guns, according to a 2017 Pew Research Center study, a right that advocates say is enshrined in the Constitution. Bridging the gap is hard, said Winkler, who outlined the polarization in a book, but notes individual states have tightened restrictions. Gun violence is a public health problem, argues author and analyst David Hemingway.
The public health approach has been incredibly useful over the last 150 years in making the world safer.
He says our lifespan has doubled in that period thanks to improved sanitation, control of infectious diseases, and other measures. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Police in Indianapolis say 8 people were shot and killed at a FedEx facility. The shooter then killed himself. A police spokesperson says several other people were injured in the Thursday night shooting. 5 were hospitalized, including one person with critical injuries. Another 2 people were treated and released at the scene. The shooter has not been identified. Police were still at the scene conducting interviews in the early hours of Friday. It was the latest in a string of mass shootings across the United States. The defense of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin rested Thursday after 3 weeks of witnesses from both sides. Jurors have heard from medical experts and other police officers as Chauvin faces murder and manslaughter charges for kneeling on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. Esha Sarai has more.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin invoked his Fifth Amendment right to not testify in his own murder trial Thursday.
Is this your decision not to testify?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. Do you have any questions about your right to remain silent or to testify on your own behalf?
Not at this time, I don't.
All right. Has anyone promised anything or threatened you in any way to keep you from testifying?
No promises or threats, Your Honor.
Do you feel that your decision not to testify is a voluntary one on your behalf?
Yes, it is.
No. The defense rested their case Thursday.
Your Honor, at this time, the defense rests.
past week, the defense has argued that Chauvin's actions against George Floyd were justified, with one former police officer countering what the prosecution's witnesses had said last week.
I felt that Officer Chauvin's interactions with Mr. Floyd were following his training, following current practices in policing, and were objectively reasonable.
The defense also argued that a number of causes may have contributed to Floyd's death, including his prior health, drug use, and possible carbon monoxide poisoning from the exhaust of the squad car.
When you put all of those together, it's very difficult to say which of those is the most accurate. So I would fall back to undetermined.
But the prosecution pushed back on the argument about carbon monoxide, calling on a rebuttal witness.
As to the statement that his carboxyhemoglobin could have increased by 10 to 18%, in your view, possible?
The prosecution and defense in Chauvin's case are expected to make closing statements on Monday before members of the jury begin deliberations. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America. A Hong Kong court has sentenced five leading pro-democracy advocates, including media tycoon Jimmy Lai, to up to 18 months in prison for organizing a march during the 2019 anti-government protests that triggered an overwhelming crackdown from Beijing. A total of nine advocates were given jail terms, but four of them, including 82-year-old lawyer and former lawmaker Martin Lee, have their sentences suspended. You are listening to International Edition of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Hundreds in Ethiopia's Tigray region have reported being subjected to horrific sexual violence, most commonly alleging that Ethiopian or Eritrean soldiers were the perpetrators. Soraya Ali of Reuters has more.
The young mother was trying to get food home to her children. Instead, she saw a soldier minibus in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region and began 11 days of horrific abuse.
There were 23 soldiers in that desert, to my surprise. All 23 have raped a single woman, me. When I screamed, they would suffocate me.
After days of rapes and beatings, she describes how the soldiers tied her up, shoved items inside her, and left her in the bush. In a Tigray hospital, her doctor, George Girme, lays out objects that were removed from the 27-year-old's vagina.
Like nail, stone, and plastic, and some cotton, like, and heavy bleeding, understand.
The woman is among hundreds who have reported sexual violence since fighting broke out in the mountainous northern region. Dr. Fasika Amde Selassie is the top public health official for the government-appointed interim administration in Tigray. He says at least 829 cases of sexual assault have been reported in five hospitals since the conflict began. But he says those reports come from women who know they can get help at healthcare facilities and who live near the region's cities. He also said that women are being held in sexual slavery, the first such claim by an Ethiopian government official. Eight doctors Reuters spoke with say most rape victims have described their attackers as either Ethiopian government or Eritrean soldiers.
That's Soraya Ali of Reuters. The World Health Organization says that raising taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products is the smartest and best way to save lives and save billions of dollars in health expenditures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 8 million people die prematurely every year from tobacco-related illnesses such as emphysema and lung cancer. Furthermore, the World Health Organization reports the cost of smoking to the global economy comes to more than $1.4 trillion in health expenditures and lost productivity. The WHO has issued a new manual on tobacco taxes to inform policymakers and others on how to create and implement the strongest tobacco taxation policies for their specific countries. Jeremiah St. Paul Jr. is head of fiscal policies and health promotion for the WHO. He says scare tactics employed by the tobacco industry are a key hindrance to raising taxes. He urges governments not to be put off by ploys aimed at undermining tobacco reforms, such as...
If you increase tobacco taxes, you increase smuggling and illicit trade, you're sued in the court. Raising tobacco taxes is anti-poor. If you increase tobacco taxes, revenues will go down and employment impact will be negative.
Paul says the new WHO manual documents countries that address these scare tactics and succeeded in raising resources through good tax administration. For example, he says the Philippines has increased its revenue and tripled its health budget by taxing tobacco.
If you raise tobacco taxes, it does more to prevent premature deaths from non-communicable diseases than any other single health intervention. If you just increase taxes by $1, you can raise about $200 billion of additional revenues.
According to the WHO, in 2018, only 38 countries, covering 14% of the global population, had sufficiently high tobacco taxes, which the agency defines as 75% of the retail price of a pack of cigarettes. When it comes to taxes, Paul says, the rule of thumb is to make sure they are high enough to make tobacco products less affordable and deter consumers from using them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigerian authorities are stepping up efforts to vaccinate more people against COVID-19 after a slow rollout blamed on misinformation. Authorities aim to vaccinate over 80 million Nigerians by year's end, but are running far behind schedule. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
This Abuja vaccination center opened in mid-March, one of many in the Nigerian capital. Between 50 to 100 people walk in here each day to get vaccinated. Olu Agumbiade is getting his first jab.
Venture out into the world with a form of protection. I know that doesn't mean I still can't contract COVID, but at least I have antibodies that can help me fight it.
Nigeria received nearly 4 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine on March 2nd. Authorities have pledged to vaccinate around 80 million people by the end of the year, but only about 1 million have so far received jabs. Even though authorities say more Nigerians are now getting vaccinated, vaccine hesitancy and misinformation about the coronavirus are to blame for the low numbers.
Very big problem, because now, start from the beginning, how many people even be living that we had the pandemic here? And now you are bringing vaccines that it is for what you do not even believe at the first instance. We have a lot of work to do.
Authorities are trying to increase vaccine awareness in communities, villages, and marketplaces to improve acceptance. Still, thousands like Abuja resident Richard Uka insist they will not get the vaccine.
Me, to be sincere, I don't think that this is necessary. To me, it's not necessary. And I believe that in Nigeria, nothing works. How do you think that vaccine works? Or how do we know that it works?
Nigeria needs to vaccinate about 150 million citizens by next year to attain herd immunity. But the availability of vaccine in large quantities may prove difficult.
But we are looking at the pandemic situation in Europe, India, and the USA and the UK. Some of them are even experiencing the third and fourth phases spikes now. And India, that was giving us, is also having spikes now. So many of the doses they have will be consumed there.
Only a few African countries are able to manufacture the coronavirus vaccines, creating a high dependence on foreign manufacturers. The WHO says the continent has so far received less than 2% of the global 690 million doses of the coronavirus vaccines. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great weekend.